Assume on Skype that our friends in the Capitol are listening.
I'm sure.
Was that raw milk you were just drinking?
It was. I've got 3 gallons in my fridge. I just went to a food drop and picked some up. So here's to raw milk.
Yay. This is Ben Stone on BadQuaker.com podcast. With me today is Eddie Free. Libertarian extraordinaire, libertarian activist superhero.
I try. I don't know. I mean, I was active back in Texas, but not until I moved to D.C. right here in the heart of Mordor. I don't know. Something, a fire has just been lit up in me, and I've just been trying to, I don't know, shake it up, I guess. You know, Ben?
I just have visions of Eddie running around in Mordor kicking orcs.
I love it. Yeah, it's funny, you know, since I moved to the East Coast, a lot's changed in my life, and just like getting involved even with, you know, in 08 when I started getting involved in the Ron Paul campaign, I've just met so many incredible people. In the liberty movement, and you know, many of us have become anarchists now, and voluntarists, and it's just some of the greatest people I've never ever known in my life. I've surrounded myself now with some amazing people, including you and so many others, and I'm really proud of that. Proud of who I've surrounded myself with, man. It says a lot about somebody when you look at the friendships that they cultivate. And I'm excited about, you know, where we're going and just this whole big group of folks, you know, all of us in this community. There's just nothing quite like it in the world.
Yeah, I was really amazed with the response to the Lemonade Day and Raw Milk Freedom Day there in Washington, D.C. You know, we owned that whole process. I mean, it was like there were people across the ocean looking at us in Europe. And we, you know, our group, those people like Pete and the other guys that came down from New Hampshire, we owned that. It was so cool. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we did. It was exciting also to see tourists coming up and actually engaging in this. And that's all it takes. It takes numbers to help the rest of the crowd to kind of join in and feel comfortable and feel safe with this. You know, there wasn't one cop, not one cop showed up, Ben. I mean, I'm sure you were watching on the live stream and you had been pushing the event for weeks now, which, you know, we really appreciate. And yeah, you know, we had Pete come in from copblock.org. We had Clyde Voluntarist from Never Take a Plea. We had Nathan Cox, Meg McClain. A lot of activists from the around the country, really. We even had an activist attorney from California come in, and she was actually selling raw milk with us, which was really cool. Yes, yeah. So just people came from all across the country. They joined us. People were watching from all across the country, and like you said, even in Europe. So it was just, I don't know. It's just exciting. And, you know, folks have asked me, well, Eddie, you moved into New Hampshire, you know, for the Free State Project. And that was my original plan. And eventually I'd like to move up there, Ben. I think that that's the way to go. But I've got some personal issues here that I have to take care of. And also, you know, me living here in D.C. gives me a stage like no other. I couldn't have, you know, me and Adam, we couldn't have pulled off the dance party like we did anywhere else. We couldn't have pulled off this Lemonade Freedom Day this last Saturday from anywhere else. The way that it went down, the impact that it had. So I think it's important that some of us are here in D.C. and mm-hmm. and doing our thing on this stage. You know, I've started the Voluntarist Experience, where I'm kind of doing a series of videos now. You know, and I'm not turning out a lot of them, but I'm making sure that they're kind of high quality, and it's just kind of covering my experiences. Here's a voluntarist in D.C., and this is what my life is like. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's really good, too. And you've got a great cameraman you're working with there, too, man. That guy is just really skilled and talented.
He really is. I come back to him and he's like, hey, man, I've already been working on the video. And I watch it. I'm like, whoa, we really don't even need to do anything. It's perfect, you know. So it's great. And it allows me to do my thing. And I don't have to worry about, you know, hey, let's get this angle or that angle. He just covers it. And he's doing it for free. You know, he's a minarchist, but he enjoys what I'm doing. And he enjoys what he does, and he's just happy to do this. So we're a great team.
That is really good to hear. You know, I've heard several different takes on what happened Saturday. Mm-hmm. Somebody said, well, it's a total victory because the cops didn't come in and try to bust us. Mm-hmm. And then I've heard other people say, well, no, in a way, you know, we would have been a lot better off if they had come in and shown their muscle. And you know how I think. I really start to put time on something and analyze it and take it apart and rip it right down to its bottom and see what really is inside there. And I was thinking about it, and I thought, from the police point of view, from the statist point of view, the smartest thing they could do is stay away from that protest. Because yes, they were in a no-win situation. If they came in and showed muscle, they'd look stupid. Mm-hmm. If they came in and tried to politely break it up, I don't know that could happen.
No, it wouldn't happen.
But they would look completely useless, you know. And their only option, you had them in a checkmate situation where any move they made, they lost. And their only option was to not move, was to stay completely out of it. And that is still an ultimate victory. Mm-hmm. Because they know they were in a position they couldn't come out and do anything. And if you've got the state in a position where it understands that it is helpless, that is the ultimate victory. And that's what we're moving towards, you know, really, in my mind, that's what we're moving towards on a worldwide basis. At some point in time, those who support the state will look around and they will go, we just can't do it. We have no move to make where we can do anything other than lose, and it'll be a total checkmate. And that's what that was. That was a picture to me. Lemonade Freedom Day 2012 was a picture to me of checkmating the state, saying any move you make, we win. And the only move you can do is not to move.
Beautiful. And that's it. Exactly. You know, either way we do win. If they aggress against us, then it just exposes them as the violent monopoly that they are. And then by them standing down, we set a precedent. Mm-hmm. We showed the world that they arbitrarily enforce their own laws. Is that the correct word? They just, you know, they pick and choose when they want to enforce these laws that really shouldn't be on the books. And so I think it was a victory. I was on the show the other day with Freedom Fiends, and Nima had asked me, you know, well, you know, don't you wish that the police would have moved? You know, it would have been more dramatic. And I understand exactly what he's talking about. People are drawn to see conflict. I mean, that's kind of human nature as far as, mm-hmm. you know, entertainment and whatnot. But I felt like it was dramatic, extremely dramatic that we stood there, we stood our ground. I mean, there was 100 of us. I mean, look at that. The numbers are what counts. You know, if it was just 3 of us out there again, you know, they might have aggressed or maybe not. I mean, it makes them look bad, Ben. You're exactly right. They look bad either way. So, but it would have been easier for them to kind of wrap it up real quick if there were maybe three of us out there again. And they could have probably grabbed us and thrown us in a van. And then that would have been it. You know, I mean, it would have been projected. The way this thing was executed, the whole thing from beginning to end unfolded flawlessly. We had conference calls, Ben, every week, as organizers, we had conference calls, and then the speakers, we would bring them in and consult with them on ideas. We brought in, Bradley Jardis and consulted Bradley Jardis, who's running for sheriff up in New Hampshire. And, we asked him, you know, questions pertaining to dealing with the police. So, and then of course we brought on Kristen Canty, the producer from, Farmageddon. And then we brought another, publicist, a professional publicist, and we had Weston A. Price, helping us as far as publicity. And, we shot out our media advisories, and then we shot out our press releases. And man, you know, by Friday we were on Drudge Report, Ben.
I mean, that is victory.
It is. I mean, how much better could it get as far as creating an event and executing it and watching the cops stand down, watching the government stand down, just like you said, checkmate. So, I have nothing to complain about with this event. It went perfectly in my mind.
I need to apologize to any listeners. I'm assuming this constant barking is coming through on the microphone. We're dog sitting my son's dog while he's moving, and so I've got a dog that's not used to being in the house, and he's kind of freaking out a little bit. I apologize to my listeners for that. And Eddie's slamming down in some more of that raw milk. I see him on his video right now.
Does the body good, let me tell you.
Yeah, it does. And let's just say something about that, because you know, I don't get as much raw milk as I would like to. It's not real convenient where we're at, but. Raw milk has a lot of real advantages health-wise over the overly processed stuff that they sell you, that white, you know, there was a Simpson episode where they referred to the milk that they were selling at school as Malk, you know, M-A-L-K, instead of M-I-L-K, it was M-A-L-K or something like that, because it was more like chalk than milk.
Well, isn't that what they did? I mean, you know, when the swill milk was killing the children from the distilleries, and I guess, what were they using? They were using the hops, I guess, for the alcohol, but yet then they were feeding the cattle, or they were feeding the cows that, and the milk was coming out blue, and this is what, the early 1900s been?
They were adding chalk
to whiten it.
Yeah, yeah. It was, they were using basically the sludge from the refiner from the distilleries. It's a nasty story. It really is. But you know, and anything that the state gets its claws around, they just twist it and bend it. And they, you know, you mentioned Mordor earlier. It's very much like that. Anything. Let's take it a really geeky in that direction. In the Tolkien story there, all of those orcs were at one time elves, and they had become, they were captured mostly in war, and in the depths of Mordor, they were tortured until they became orcs. So you have in Tolkien's storyline, you have this beautiful thing, these elves that were peaceful and beautiful and just perfect almost in their stature. And the more that they were affected by the state, which Tolkien very much represents Mordor and Sauron as the state throughout his writings. And he's even made anarchist statements, so I'm not twisting that too far out of reality there. But the deeper that these good people, the good elves, the deeper they were drawn into Mordor, the more they were twisted and the uglier they became. And that's what the state does to people.
That's interesting. You know, and they do. The people have children. These beautiful children come to us as gifts. And the state takes them, Ben, and they put them through the public education system. You know, they're beautiful children. They're bright. They're vibrant. They're healthy. They're energetic. And then the state runs them through their education. They drug them on, you know, all these Ritalin and all these other drugs, and turns them into into statists. Twists them into something that they weren't meant to be. That's interesting. Yeah. That's an interesting analogy that you just drew there. Thanks.
Kind of on a downer though. I didn't mean to take us down. We were on a victory high there, and that just took us right down into the swamps.
Okay. Well, hey, thank God we've got unschooling and we've got all these homeschool families, so there is light at the end of the tunnel, right?
Yeah. Yep. So, and that's what we're moving towards.
That is. It is.
So anyway, you got the T-shirt, I assume.
I did. Kai came right up to me, and we just I gave her a big old hug, and she said, "Hey, this is from Bad Quaker." And so, yeah, I got the shirt. I was wearing it for Freedom Fiends the other day, so kind of showing it off to Michael. And yeah, so it was great to meet Kai. And so we just, you know, I don't know, man, we've just created this really amazing community out here now. And, you know, we create these events and friends show up, and really, I mean, it's like a social thing for me now. You know, I don't even go to parties. I don't go to parties. I don't really go to clubs or bars or that kind of thing. You know, I'm worried about the cops, and I find it harder now to get along with statists. And maybe that's maybe I'm being a little too touchy about that subject, but I can't help but just think that, you know, if they're not going to listen to me explain the non-aggression principle, if they're not going to try to even grasp the fact that what they're doing is aggression against me, how can I sit at a table with you and drink with you and enjoy a conversation about, you know, other things?
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean. It's really difficult to, you know, to fill in those gaps. You're talking to somebody, and if you take liberty off the table, you take the zero aggression principle off the table, you take all these things that we find so precious and so important, you take those off the table, and what are you left with? Well, you know, it's hot today. Well, yeah, it wasn't as hot as yesterday. Man, what a wonderful conversation. I'm going home.
Yeah, exactly. But the lack of them not understanding the non-aggression principle, it affects their life, and it affects my life. And I don't know. I guess I'm just getting too touchy. But I have really, since I've moved here to the East Coast from Texas, I've just, you know, done all that I could to just surround myself with good liberty-minded people, and they're some of the best relationships I've ever had in my life.
Yeah, that's one of the really great things about everything that's going on in New Hampshire. You know, you get a few of those people together. Well, there's an old biblical saying that says, I can't quote it exactly, but it says a three cord rope is hard to break. In other words, I can't remember the whole quote, but essentially, you know, whatever strength that one has, two together have more strength than one plus one. And if you take one plus one plus one, people-wise, you know, three people have more strength together than three individual people. So there's a multiplying effect. And when we hold together, when we band together, and we all pull in the same direction, there's a tremendous amount of leverage that comes from that.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, you see, like what happened Saturday, we merged with the Food Freedom Activists. I really didn't know much about it. You know, I've gone to Whole Foods. I go to Whole Foods as often as I can, but from learning from these other activists, in the food freedom, I mean, I've learned that, you know, even Whole Foods is not enough. These folks, and this is what's sad about the times that we're in though, is the fact that food is now activism. To obtain real food, nutrient-based food has now become activism. But these folks have realized, you know, you can't even get real food at Whole Foods for the most part. You have to go directly to the farmer. And that's what these activists that we merged with are all about, connecting the farmer to the consumer and taking out the state out of the middle of it, taking out all the regulation, licensing. And that's what the government hates. They hate that these folks are doing this and that they're that they're just leaving the government. And that's what they're doing. It's agorism in its purest form, what these folks are doing, providing the raw milk, providing meat that is non-GMO fed pork, grass-fed beef. So it's opened up a whole new world to me, this food freedom. And I'm researching it more. I've met some great friends, and I'm getting more involved in this now. In September, we're going to go to a farmer's market, and we're going to sell raw milk in New York, City, right in the middle of it. We're going to do it. So,
wow.
And we've got some other ideas, cooking right now. So, and the people I met, they were just, you know, very, really great folks. And so you're right. What happened was, Robert Fernandez and I, we brought Pete in from copblock.org, and we brought Clyde, and we brought activists from our side of the liberty movement. And then of course, Liz Reitzig brought all of the food freedom folks, and that, just like you said, we merged together and we were a stronger force. I mean, it was synergy and it was created, and we were a larger force than each of us, even each of us as a whole. So yeah, I understand what you're saying. So and that's what's happening. There's this crossover of liberty and different groups, and it's just creating this huge massive movement. So, you know, I think only good things are going to happen. I think things are going to get bad. I think they are going to get very bad. But I think in the end it's going to work out, because you know, they like we were saying, they just expose themselves, and they're just going to wake up more and more people as they aggress.
Yeah, absolutely. I need to save this file in case anything crashes. Okay. So let me pause this, and I'll stick a commercial in here for the podcast, and we'll be right back. I'd like to talk to you about Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. The Liberty Classroom is a collection of courses on history and Austrian economics presented in an easy, convenient way. There are video files and audio files you can download. You can participate in discussions online in the discussion boards. And there are live sessions with Tom Woods and the other educators where you can directly interact with the instructors. Now, who is this for? It's for anyone who realizes that they didn't get the real story in government-approved schools. It's also great for homeschoolers and unschoolers. Join Tom Woods and his team, and they'll equip you with one of the very best tools the Liberty Movement has to offer, knowledge, real knowledge in a usable form. At Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, you can get all this for only $99 a year. Now, that's less than the cost of one movie DVD a month. This gets you access to absolutely everything on their site, all the courses plus additional courses that'll be added later, the discussion forums, the live sessions, everything. So how do you do this? You go to badquaker.com. You click on the banner for Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. By using that link, you'll let Tom know that I sent you, and you'll help keep badquaker.com on the internet. Thank you very much. Okay, and we're back from the commercial break. This is Ben Stone of badquaker.com with Eddie Free, Liberty activist extraordinaire.
Why, thank you, sir.
In Washington, D.C., in the heart of Evil City, USA, fighting crime, fighting real crime. I always imagine Eddie has somewhere in a closet, somewhere in his house, a cape and a spandex bright, like, you know, black and yellow, a black and gold spandex outfit that he runs around the city and fights crime with.
Maybe one day. That sounds like a lot of fun, actually. But I'll probably just totally get beat down by the cops for that. You know? Let's get that anarchist vigilante.
I want to apologize to my listeners again. I have this dog in the background that's just going to be relentless. All the early, for the really old-time listeners of my podcast, almost all of the early podcasts would be interrupted either by a cat attacking the microphone or by the dogs barking or something. So this is kind of a flashback for that.
Hey, Ben, I wanted to ask you, you were talking about knives on one show, and that you often keep knives within, you know, within reach. And I wanted to ask you, are these like throwing knives or combat fighting knives? What, can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. I have different places all over. And some people are going to say this as well. He's crazy. He's paranoid. Well, sure I am. Of course. So, you know, I've had over 35 concussions. Of course I'm crazy. I am of the opinion. I believe in guns. I'm a strong supporter in guns. I own guns and I like guns. I like shoot guns. But within a house, even as a self-defense tool, a gun is a very dangerous thing because, you know, you wake up, you're half awake, you're half asleep, you're not really sure what's going on. You're fumbling with a safety. You're not sure if the person coming into your house is one of your kids or a drunk neighbor or a really bad person or a cop, you know. And the last thing you want to do is that Marine in, I think it was New Mexico, showed when he was trying to defend his family by, you know, having a gun out when he thought bad guys were coming and it turned out to be SWAT and they just shot him down with 60 times they hit him, mm-hmm. and then left him to bleed. Well, you don't want that kind of a situation. So I believe in-house, your best defense, and you know, if you're really good with a gun, that's different. I'm not that good with a handgun. I'm not at all good with a handgun, and I'm better with a long gun, you know, hitting a target at 100 yards or more out. That's more of my specialty. So I'm not good inside short distances, you know. So maybe that's part of it too. But I know this, and this is coming from direct experience. If I need to move 10, 15 yards in that range, and a person has a firearm type weapon, mm-hmm. I am surprisingly dangerous with a blade. And they are surprisingly taken aback by a 250-pound, 6-foot-tall man charging their firing gun. And I've seen this firsthand. I've actually had a person shooting at me as I charge them and snatch the gun out of their hand and totally compromise their situation. Not because I'm a hero, but because it was like, this is the only thing I can do. This is what I have to do. So, mm-hmm. you know, you have to do it. So, yeah, so around my house I have antique bayonets from the 1800s. I have one Wilkinson bayonet from 1898, I believe.
Why is it called a Wilkinson?
That was the official sword maker to the Queen in England.
I see.
And so it's a Wilkinson sword manufacturer that made this bayonet. It's a 20, I believe it's a 20, I believe the blade is 22 inches long. Wow. So essentially it's a short sword, mm-hmm. but it's pretty impressive. And then I have a variety of German bayonets from Mausers that are 18, 20 inches long. And I have hatchets, machetes, throwing knives, all in different places. I can pretty much reach one wherever I'm at in the house.
It seems like with a blade too, I mean, if you've mastered the skill, you know, you shoot a bullet, you can't slow it down and you can't pull it back.
Right.
And like you were talking about, and that's in a situation, say it's a drunk neighbor, you can, and you don't necessarily know who it is, but you strike at them and then let's say maybe you recognize them. Well, you could probably soften the blow. Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah.
You could kind of control the weapon a little bit better. You can't control a bullet once it's already flying.
Yeah, absolutely. Even as the strike is in the process of going, you can always deflect yourself and change the direction and not make the strike hit its target. And it does. It is a little bit of a skill thing. You got to put away some of the movie Hollywood stuff, and you know, I can demonstrate how to hold a knife rather than how do you put this. If you think of the knife as an extension of the fist, to where if you hold your fist out in front of you with your thumb, let's say you're right-handed, your thumb is towards the center and toward the left. If you're right-handed, your thumb would be to the left, and the base of your hand would be out to the right. If you're left-handed, of course, then the thumb is to the right and your hand is to the left. Well, if you were striking in that position, if the knife is coming out the opposite direction of your thumb, then the knife extends your strike for the length of the blade. So if you have a 4-inch blade or a 6-inch blade or a 10-inch blade, the strike of your fist is now 10 inches longer. On the other hand, if someone grabs your arm by the wrist, and if you're holding that blade so that the blade comes out through your thumb area, they've got you. You can't get your hand into a position where you can do any damage to them if their hand is stronger than your arm. But if you've got that blade coming out the opposite side of your thumb, you can just take your hand and put it right down into their wrist with that blade.
Oh, yeah.
And they will immediately release. So you have both a defensive and offensive advantage just in that one piece of knowledge on how to hold the blade. Also, the fighting stance that a person would take with their fists is already natural to every 12-year-old boy. And as the blade comes out the opposite end of your hand from your thumb, then it's in a natural position in your fighting position. So your strike you don't have to change your training on how you would box, except for the fact that you've now got essentially a claw coming out that end of your hand. So, but again, even as that strike is throwing, you can move it and not make it impact at the very last second. Mm-hmm. If you realize that the person you're about to strike is a friendly that's just, you know, in the wrong place at the wrong time or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, you know, you were talking about self-defense. This is gun related, but, back in Texas a few years ago, I was coming back from a goose hunt, and I had all my decoys loaded on the back of my truck. I had my dog in the kennel in the back of my truck. I was still wearing my camo, and I was driving home on the freeway, and these two guys in a pickup just decided to start messing with me. And it was really stupid on their part. They should have seen, you know, the decoys in the back of my truck, seen me in the camo and realized, hey, this guy might have a gun. Well, they pulled up next to me. I was in the far left lane. They pulled up next to me and started swerving towards me, and to where I had to slow down. I eventually got over to the far right lane, and you've probably seen people do this. They'll kind of swerve mm-hmm. and kind of try to intimidate you. Well, they pull in front of me, and they start slamming on their brakes to where I've got to slam on mine to avoid from hitting them, and they pull up next to me and they throw change. I don't know if you've ever had money thrown at you and have it hit your car while you're driving. It is a loud cracking sound, and it's terrifying. It's a terrifying sound. I thought they shot at me, Ben. It scared me to the point where I thought, my God, these guys are going to try to kill me. Well, I slowed down, and they came around to the left side of me, and I grabbed my shotgun and I threw a shell in there, and I stuck it out my window, and they slowed down, and they came, right next to my driver's side window, and I had that shotgun just, about 4 inches of this barrel. And it's a 28 inch barrel, full shadow grass camo, and I had about 4 inches of it just sticking out my window. And the passenger, he saw it. His eyes turned into two giant white plates. The truck slammed on the brakes and then skidded over to the right, and they took the next exit, and that was the end of it. All I had to do. So, man. Lesson learned for them. Do not mess with people in camouflage. Let me tell you. Yeah.
And it's hard to tell what their intent really was. They may have been planning on robbing you or anything. It's hard to tell what they were planning.
Really? I don't know. Yeah. Well, the way they slowed down in front of me, they slowed me down to about 20 miles an hour, just creeping along. And then it swerved around them and took off, and they caught back up with me. And that's when I pulled out my shotgun and pointed it at them. And man, they took off. They were scared the hell out of them, So I've had a couple of little run-ins. I had another guy pull a gun on me one time and pointed it right at my head. And it was interesting what you said. You just move, you just react. And the guy pointed it at my head, and you know, I used my left hand and I grabbed the gun, and my right hand was free to take care of him. But you know, it's unfortunate those kind of things happen. But you know, we've got to be prepared for them. You know, people can call us paranoid all they want, but like you said, you know, you've suffered multiple you know, concussions. Me, I've had guns pointed at me, so. You know, you just never know what's going to happen. You never know what's going to happen in this world.
It really is important to be to have an awareness of what's around you and what people's intent, because there are bad people out there. You know, there are people who really get entertainment out of being bad, and you never know when you're going to encounter one of them. You know, I know there's a lot of hype in the media and everything like that, but you get these crazed shooters that go in or whatever, or if they're false flags or whatever, I don't know. You know, there's a lot of theories one way or the other with these, like the shooters in the temple and the shooters at the theater and places like that. But I kind of have a mentality all the time. Like I was in the doctor's office yesterday, and I'm sitting there and I'm realizing how many people are in there and how vulnerable they are. And if somebody was to walk in, what would I do? And I immediately realized where the columns were in the room, how I could get behind what I needed to get behind in order to get to them. And I just kind of, in my mind, just took like 2 minutes and plotted it out. And yeah, somebody could say, well, it's because you're crazy and you're paranoid. On the other hand, if there would have been anybody in that theater that would have walked in, sat down, looked around and said, okay, what am I going to do if this happens, what am I going to do if that happens, thought about the scenarios, then when the gunman came into the theater, he would have probably only got off a couple shots and they would have been taking him down. You know, it's all about, I think there's something deep in our spirit that tells us that this is our job. And I don't want to sound macho or whatever, but it's like, you know, we hold that down and there's so much in society that represses that. Mm-hmm. And yet it's a job that we've had since the very first tiger jumped out of the bushes. And, you know,
you're exactly right. And in society, you know, pop culture, or I don't, you know, necessarily know what it is, the dumbing down and the demasculization even of men. We've moved away from that. We no longer are in contact with our instincts. You know, a man knows his environment. A man knows his history. You know, he knows how to survive. And and we've lost that. Now we just, you know, we go to the grocery store and we pick up our steak and, you know, and we eat fast food and we get our excitement out of watching other people live their lives on the television. We're no longer engaging in wildlife and no longer engaging in nature and becoming a part of the earth like we once were. You're right. You know, since the dawn of time, we've had to watch out for that tiger that's out there. And now, I mean, now it's the state as well. But then there is this element that's still out there, and so many people just, you know, I still know people that just leave their front door open. I do not get that. How can you leave your front door unlocked while you're sleeping at night? It's insane to me.
Yeah, and I know that there are places, like I have relatives in Appalachia, and there are places back in Appalachia where it's so safe that people will literally walk away from their house for 2 or 3 days and leave it all unlocked because they figure, well, if my neighbor needs something, they'll go in and get it, and they'll just, you know. And I understand that in places like that in Appalachia where you know all your neighbors and there's this certain level of trust, but most of society, most of Western culture is not like that. Mm. It's like there's, you know, so much of those good people have become those orcs that I was referring to earlier. Mm-hmm. They're just walking around waiting for the opportunity to find a door that's unlocked.
You know, we're going to see more of this too, Ben. You know, as the economy crashes, we're going to see more crime. It's inevitable. So, yeah. You know, we have to arm ourselves, you know, physically and with knowledge and just be aware, you know, you got so many kids, excuse me, we've got kids that I've got some nephews and I tell them, you know, that they just need to watch their surroundings, be careful. You know, you go out and especially drinking is very dangerous. It's extremely dangerous, not just because of the impact on your body and your physical health, but the fact that, you know, when you're drunk and you're partying down in, you know, in Matamoros, you know, Mexico, you just might get kidnapped and be killed by a satanic cult. Like what happened in 1993, it really happened.
Yeah.
You know, these spring break kids go down there and they're partying and they don't pay attention to their surroundings. They end up getting kidnapped and murdered. So this thing happens and, you know, we need to be aware of that. And so I, you know, people call me paranoid for having guns and, you know, whatever, you know, I'd rather have a gun, you know, I'd rather have a gun and be prepared than not be prepared and be dead.
Yeah, absolutely. And a little shout out to the wonderful folks at Pork Fest. You know, there was a lot of drinking that happened at Pork Fest.
Sure, but it was all very responsible. I mean, for the most part, you know, but, you know, and there were people armed. You know, I went to, I saw the playground. The playground, it was fascinating. Children were playing on the jungle gym and all of that, and their fathers were all standing around with pistols on their hips. Those were the safest children on the planet at that very moment.
Yeah, can you imagine a bad guy even remotely, you know, if you just happen to wander in there and look around, it's like, oh man, I'm in the wrong place.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, I gotta find a public school. This place is crazy.
Well,
here.
I mean, let me ask you, I mean, the old West, you know, we see these shootouts and people think, oh, well, if they legalize guns, then, you know, there's going to be people shooting each other everywhere and all that. Well, a lot of people had guns back in the West. I mean, everyone had guns. You know, a rifle would lean against the mantle in the living room, and even the 6-year-old child, I'm sure, knew not to touch that.
Right.
You know, so, but there wasn't. I mean, what was it like? I mean, there wasn't like this rampant violence and all these shootouts at high noon and all of that. You know, was there?
No, yeah. There's been several history scholars that have done a lot of work on that and that have shown that that's entirely a Hollywood made-up thing. All the bank robberies and railroad robberies and so forth. One researcher from University of Dayton found out that from it was something like 1870 to like 1900, all the bank robberies that took place in the entire United States were not as much as took place in Dayton, Ohio, in the year that he did the research, which was like 2007 or something like that. There were more bank robberies just in Dayton, Ohio in 1 year than happened in the entire U.S. from like 1870 to 1900.
Who would rob a bank when everybody else standing in line to get their money is carrying a weapon? Who would do it?
Yeah, exactly. That's actually a historical thing. That's what happened to the James and the Younger gangs, two of the largest of the, you know, of the crime gangs of the 1800s. They all went to Northfield, Minnesota to rob a bank that was supposedly a very rich bank. Mm-hmm. And they went in, they checked the place out, they scoped it all out, they figured out how they were going to rob the bank. They went in to rob the bank, but the citizenry were so well armed. And, you know, there was no insurance in those days to protect your deposits. So the money in that bank belonged to those local citizens. And the local citizens just shot those gangs to pieces. Cole Younger was shot something like 20 times. Frank James was hit. Frank and Jesse James barely got out alive. Most of the gang members got shot up pretty bad. And Cole Younger was arrested over it and spent years in jail over it. But yeah, it was dangerous to be a bad guy back then when everybody else was armed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope we can get back to that eventually. I think New Hampshire and the Free State Project's a good start. Open carry is, we've got open carry actually here in Virginia. I'm thinking about doing some open carry activism too. It's a really touchy subject though. So,
how
do you play it? How do you play it off? Because, on one side of it, if you are actively open carrying, you can bring the issue out into the forefront and possibly, anger enough liberals to, vote in enough guns to force you to put your gun away. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So some folks are like, well, no, maybe we shouldn't do open carry activism because we've got the right now, and they're scared to actually use it because then that right may be supposedly taken away.
Yeah, they could actually lose ground by the swelling of public support. It's kind of like the opposite of what happened. We made a lot of ground in the liberty movement last year in the lemonade thing when the cops came in and overreacted.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's kind of the same thing. If we overreact and make guns too much of a focus, the leftists and the people that are so dependent on the government could overreact, and we could really have a harder battle than we need to have. So I can see the argument both directions.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and they control the media. I mean, for the most part,
yeah.
We're becoming the media ourselves, but we still have a long way to go. I mean, the mainstream media has just got such a grasp. I mean, not to bring up the elections, but I mean, Ron Paul, he won. He won. He had the popular vote. And they covered, they stole the votes away from him, and the media just covered it up. I mean, it was just so obvious what they did to him. How anybody can't see that is beyond me. But it's such a force to be fighting against. You'd had a podcast that you talked about the state being a dragon, and this dragon, we can engage this dragon. We can grab onto one of its scales, and we can, lift it up, and we can injure it. But that dragon eventually, you had said that dragon eventually will turn around and stomp on us.
Yeah.
And it has that ability. So that was an interesting podcast, Ben, because you had talked about Judge Andrew Napolitano making a statement saying the first person who shoots down a drone will be a hero.
Yeah.
And you'd said that, that was really an irresponsible statement. And I didn't think about that, Ben. When I'd heard that Napolitano statement, I was like a lot of people, and I was like, oh yeah, hoorah. Yeah, but you're right. We can't let them choose the battleground. They know how to engage someone in a uniform. They know how to engage someone with a gun, as someone carrying a flag. They don't know how to engage a bunch of mothers selling milk on the Capitol lawn.
Exactly. Precisely. Man, I couldn't said it any better. That's exactly it. That is exactly it. Yeah, I make the argument that this dragon, this state, we can go around and we can expose it. We can show others what evil that it does. We can point to it. We can even poke at it and make it wiggle a little now and then. But if we ever draw its attention, any one person or any one group, any movement that ever draws its real attention, the state, just like a dragon, will move against us with great swiftness, and it will, it will Ruby Ridge, Waco. I mean, you could just start the list.
This is the anniversary, by the way, of when Ridge started. I guess it was a 3-day ordeal, and today's the anniversary of when they eventually massacred those three family members.
Yeah. Yeah, shot a little boy down, shot his dog, shot the little boy, then shot his mother holding a baby, and then held the family basically held them captive inside their cabin, where if they even came near a window or whatever, they would shoot at them. Mm-hmm. And they were stuck in there with the dead bodies during the entire siege. Mm-hmm.
That poor little boy, they shot his arm off.
Yeah.
They'd shot his dog. And, you know, naturally, I mean, I grew up with dogs, and I would have done the same thing as that little boy. I would have kept running out. I would have been running up to my dog.
Yeah.
And and so they shot him. They shot his arm off with a machine gun and just shot him right up the back when he took off running away from them.
Yeah. It's pretty sobering. And that's the way the state reacts. It has no feelings. It has no... You know, it has no remorse. There was never any remorse shown by the government for that action.
Oh no, they will never admit guilt. They actually said, "Oh well, yeah, we injected some people in South America with syphilis," you know, something like that. But what they did at Waco, what they did at Ruby Ridge, they'll never admit to it. You know, I mean, what they did at Waco. I mean, look what they did. They demolished the buildings and then they put a park over it, or they put a memorial over it and covered up the whole damn crime scene.
Yeah. Yeah. They didn't treat it at all. Yeah. They didn't treat it at all in a forensic manner to find out facts or truth. That was the opposite of what they wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, they shot tear gas, flammable tear gas in Waco. They shot flammable tear gas, and I don't know. I mean, the video I saw of the FLIR from the plane, it looks like there's tanks shooting fire into that building. And during the Senate hearings, the ATF said, no, we didn't use flammable tear gas. No, we didn't. No, we didn't. Well, it took the Texas Rangers to step up and say, no, y'all are full of it. Here's the evidence. The Texas Rangers presented the flammable tear gas.
Yeah, the canisters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And when they went into the final, what they were calling the bunker, which was actually kind of like a root cellar or a cold storage area, and it was also for like a storm cellar. If you're living in that area of Texas, you really need to have some kind of tornado, protection. And so they did have a cement structure that was for that purpose. And that's where the women and children were hiding during the siege. Mm-hmm. And they poked a hole through that wall and pumped the tear gas in. Mm-hmm. And when they found the bodies of the children, the pain of dealing with the tear gas was so intense that it cramped the bodies of the children and distorted them into unnatural positions and snapped their spines. It's more than a person can even hardly talk about.
Mm-hmm. It made the muscles that gas made the muscles contract so hard that the bones actually snapped. Yeah, their spines and there's photographic evidence of it, but now it's just all, you know, who taught it, it's all just forgotten about. I mean, this whole country is built on millions of lives that have been taken by the state, and you know they raise the crime scene, and then they create a park or some memorial, and then it's just all brushed under the rug, and you know, and covered up with an American flag, and hoorah, we're free.
It's really messed up, and that's going back to what we were saying a second ago. That's what happens when that dragon notices you. So what we have to do is we have to let other people see the absurdity of the state, while not engaging it to the point of where it sees us. And then eventually, at some point in time, I've said this a lot of times before, there'll be a market for freedom. There is a market for freedom, but that market for freedom will increase with the more people that understand how the state really is. And at some point in time, it'll be just like there with you guys at the Lemonade Day, where the market for freedom is greater than the state's ability to oppress it. And the state will just become instantly not a factor. It just won't matter anymore, because nobody will care what the state's doing. We're going to be free.
And
the state will instantly be weak.
That's what I like to think of it as. You know, just like how we look at pyramids, or we look at Zeus, or we look at a statue of Taurus, this big cow. You know, we just kind of laugh at them now. And I think one day that the future generations will do the same thing. They'll just see the state as a silly superstition.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good metaphor right there. I was talking one time about, you know, you say, well, the gods live up on top of the mountain. And somebody says, really? I'm going to go up on the mountain. And he comes back down. He's like, I was on the mountain. There was no gods. Well, it's only when the clouds come in. The gods are only there when the clouds come in. So the guy goes up and on the mountain. He's like, I was up there. The clouds came and went. No gods. And the story has to keep adjusting till pretty soon they stop saying that the gods are on the mountain. You know, you got to make up a whole different story or something because this one's not working out. And that's what we're doing. We're going up there. We're going, look, I've been up there. I looked. I stood around. I waited for the clouds. There's no gods on the mountain. It's just a bunch of thugs. You know, that's all the state is. It's just people. It's just, how did Lysander Spooner say it? They're just...
robbers and thieves.
Yeah, yeah. They're just highwaymen. They're no different than the highwaymen, except they have the audacity to try to convince you that what they're doing is good for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess that's the whole idea behind religion as well, at least in my eyes.
I would call it organized religion. You know, whatever a person believes in themselves, that's their own business. Mm-hmm. But I see the same thing with the general organized religion that people, anytime you have, you know, one guy or a group of guys, group of people, I suppose it could be females as well, that are telling people, you know, my description of God and the heavens and all this is the one you have to believe. Now give me some money, you know.
The God I believe in isn't short of cash.
Yeah. Yeah, that... It just sounds a little fishy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's funny. You know, they're sitting there, yeah, give to the poor. But then you'll see the Pope, he's sitting there holding a staff that's made of solid gold and living in the Vatican, you know, and all this opulence, you know, it's insane.
Yeah, or the TV evangelist is the same way, you know.
Exactly.
He's telling everybody, you know, I know you're suffering, but if you just send me another $10 a month.
Yes.
Oh, man.
Yeah. People fall for this thing all the time. They fall for those sycophants and the state. It's quite the con they got going.
Hey, I probably ought to wrap this up. I really appreciate you coming on the show with me today.
Yeah, you betcha. Yeah, looks like we're on for about an hour so far.
Yeah. Yeah. I skipped past our last break.
Okay.
That's okay. That's okay. The listeners can go without a commercial. They'll probably appreciate
it. Well, man, listen, I love your show, Ben. I really enjoy when you go into history and your insight as far as what role it's played. And man, I would love to come back on if I can sometime, Ben.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, always. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we chat all the time on Facebook and stuff,
yeah,
and on the phone and stuff. Yeah. And so, yeah, we always got an open mic for you, buddy.
All right. Well, thanks for having me on, Ben.
Hey, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it. And I'll talk to you a little bit later.
Okay.
Thanks, Eddie.